way there in your Bible. Remember where we are. I know you may be getting kind of fatigued a little bit from me continually reminding you of this. But Jesus has been in the temple. This is just a couple of days prior to the Last Supper. And he's been teaching. He's been locking horns with his religious adversaries, the scribes, the Pharisees, those people that Sadducees, Pharisees, scribes, etc., lawyers. They were very upset, angry, and for good reason actually, because Jesus has been not withholding any kind of criticism because of their religious legalism. In chapter 23, he actually just goes after them with those seven woes. Woe to the scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, he called them. If you want to really get a self-righteous religious person ticked, that's a good way of doing it. He didn't hold anything back. And he pointed out the hypocrisy of their religious expressions, how they would strain at gnats but swallow camels, how they would distort God's will, thinking the whole time that they were keeping and obeying God's will. And then Jesus, in chapter 24, he leaves the temple area, the Temple Mount. He crosses the Kidron Valley. He goes up on the Mount of Olives, which is not... it's a hill, not a mountain. It's just a row of hills, really. It's called the Mount of Olives. It's on the east side of Jerusalem, east side of the Temple Mount. And there with his disciples, he began answering their questions. I prefaced it when they were leaving the temple area. They were marveling at the big stones. We talked about that last week. And then Jesus was answering a couple of questions. They wanted to know, what will be the sign of his coming, and when will it be, his coming be, and what will be the sign of the end of the age? When is it going to happen? And in chapter 24, Jesus, remember, he does what rabbis, Jewish rabbis, would often do. He would not just say A, B, C, and D. What he would do is he would talk around it. He'd talk around one of these particular requests or questions. Then he'd move to the other one. Then he'd move back to this one. And he did that. And they would understand it probably far better than we, because we are more linear thinkers. We like A, B, C, and D. But Jesus didn't approach it that way. He's still talking to his disciples. They're still across the Kidron Valley, in an area that later is going to be the place where he's going to be arrested. There's a garden there, but the garden is not, we misunderstand it. The garden is not the Garden of Gethsemane. Matter of fact, it's never even called a garden, really. But it's an olive grove with a Gethsemane there. And a Gethsemane is an olive press. And there's a lot of interesting parallels. I'll bring these out probably again in maybe more detail when we get there. But some of the interesting things about that is it is a large stone that is suspended on a pole, a rather large pole. And what they would do is they would have a trough there, and they would make baskets of olives, and they lay them there, and they would lower the weight on it. Well, there were three squeezings. The first squeezing was the best olive oil, and it went to wealthy people, it went to powerful people, and so that first squeezing was the most valuable. Then they would add more weight to a second squeezing, and they would do it a second time, collecting more olive oil. Now this oil would be used more for common purposes. It could be used to help in lights, you know, and in lamps. It could be used to make soap, just different things. it would be used for. And then, of course, there'd be that third and final squeezing. They'd add more weight, and they would crush it again. And actually, when they got through with the third, there wasn't any olive oil left. It was the husks, as you were, the olives themselves, would be just about as dry as they could be because they squeezed every bit out of it. Three squeezings. That press is called a Gethsemane. A Gethsemane. So when we think about, sometimes we think that's the name of the place. Well, yes and no. It's an olive grove with a Gethsemane in it. Now there's also a similar use of some of those stones, and it was used in executions. All right? So a condemned man would be forced to lay on his back, and then a stone, one of those stones, would be placed on his chest. And then a second stone would be added. And then a third stone. And you obviously, by this time, you know there's no breathing going on. And sometimes a man's chest would crush because of the weight of the Gethsemane stones upon him. So that's something to bear in mind. That's where they are. That's where Jesus and his disciples are staying at night. That first night, before the triumphal entry, they were going out to Bethany. Second night, out to Bethany. But now they're staying in, apparently, they're staying in that area, taking refuge there in that particular area. So he's talking to his disciples. Now, don't forget what he mentioned in the last verse of chapter 24. Talking about faithful servants. And he said, it talked about the one that was not faithful, the wicked servant. He said in verse 51, he will cut him to pieces and sign him a place with the hypocrites, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now, he's mentioned that phrase before, but he's going to mention it again. Remember the context. These are warnings, not simply predictive statements about what's coming. They are warnings about the importance of remaining faithful and then the consequences of being unfaithful. All right? So, chapter 25, verse 1. At that time, the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins. So he's going to tell a story, a parable. He does not say that the kingdom of heaven is, he says, he uses the word like. A simile, it's something like it. And he's going to compare it. He's going to use an example that was well understood. Because in the ancient world, first century Palestine, first century Israel, what you have there is you have two real social events. What are those social events? Weddings and funerals. Those are the big events that people turn out for. So they're going to understand what he's talking about. So he begins, at that time the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins. Or you may have a translation that renders that bridesmaids. Because that's what they are primarily in our vernacular. Who took their lamps and went out to meet the groom. Five of them were foolish and five were wise. When the foolish took their lamps, they did not take oil with them, but the wise ones took oil in their flasks with their lamps. When the groom was delayed, they all became drowsy and fell asleep. Okay. Now notice, there's no distinction being made at this point, other than the wisdom, the wise, and the foolish. These 10 ladies, five of them have extra oil. Five of them don't. The groom is delayed. We don't know why he's delayed. He's just delayed. He didn't come at the time that they were anticipating or hoping he would. So he comes later. And they all become drowsy and they fall asleep. How many of them? All. All 10 of these girls go to sleep. In the middle of the night, there was a shout. Here's the groom. Come out to meet him. Okay? Again, now we've talked about wedding customs prior to this. Jesus does not deal with all the different details. But you did not send out invitations announcing the time of the wedding and then having guests to RSVP if they were going to come to the wedding. It wasn't like that. It was an event that, as Jesus already alluded to in chapter 24, it would be an event where when the Father says it's time for the wedding. Okay? So, at this point, the groom's delayed. When he comes, they wake up. They're supposed to be ready. They're supposed to be prepared for his arrival. They know basically when it's going to be, because usually at the betrothal period is about a year. So when you get to month 10, 11, you probably think, it could be any time now. And it's okay. So here they come. There's a shout. It's usually one of his groom, we call him groomsman, one of his attendants that was hanging around with the groom that would come and he would be shouting. As a matter of fact, John the Baptist likened himself to being the friend of the groom. He's not the groom, but he's the friend of the groom. So, you know, making the announcement. So he'd be making the announcement. There'd be a lot of racket because it would wake up the whole village. And those who were ready would go. Then all the virgins got up and trimmed their lamps. The foolish ones said to the wise ones, give us some of your oil, because our lamps are going out. The wise ones answered, no, there will not be enough for us and for you. Go instead to those who sell oil and buy some for yourselves. Now, that verse alone could be the information for a very, very pointed sermon. The five wise are not being selfish. They're being realistic. It would be an insult for them not to be ready. The foolish ones were not prepared. So when the cry comes, when the groom is on his way, when it's time to go out and meet him, the others, well, they don't have enough oil. Their lamps are not going to burn long enough. They're going to go out. So they want to borrow oil. And the five wise are not, they're not being selfish. They're not, well, they won't share. My goodness, how come they wouldn't share? Because if they would share, there wouldn't be enough for all of them. Now, where this verse can be applied is, and I could go a lot of different directions with this here, but maybe just suffice it to say this. You can't get ready for anybody else. You can't. You can't get ready for your parents. You can't get ready for your children. You can't get ready for your grandchildren. You cannot do that. You can only get ready for yourself. Are you hearing me?
That's right.
It's important that we get hold of this. We get very sentimental, and people get very sentimental, thinking because grandmother was such a wonderful saint that somehow that's going to be beneficial to me. Well, it'll be beneficial as far as her example. But her righteousness, as it were, does not transfer to you. And that's important we get a hold of. People have the strangest ideas sometimes. They think, well, you know, Dad was a very righteous man. Surely that has some bearing on... No, it wouldn't. No, it won't. You may have heard the kind of statement, I don't know who made it first, but God has no grandchildren. And this gets really, really close to us. For the mere fact, there is none of your faithfulness to God transfers to your kids. None. That's sobering. especially when you have children or grandchildren or nieces or nephews that you know are not living, have no relationship with the Lord, that your the righteousness, your faithfulness, I should do it that way, your faithfulness to God cannot and will not ever transfer to them. That's the point. You cannot be ready for anyone else. They're going to have to be ready for themselves. Jesus is pointing that out. You got five wise, they're prepared. You got five unwise, they are not. And there's no transference going on there. When they had gone to buy some, the groom arrived, and those who were, what's the next word? I don't know in your translation what it says.
Ready.
Ready. Those that are ready went in with him to the wedding banquet, and the door was shut. Now, when I read that phrase, and I mean, it's not like it's the first time I've ever read it. There is something that echoed in my mind from the Old Testament. I'm going to fish for it just a little bit. That's it. When the ark's door was shut. When the door was shut, it's too late. They had opportunity prior when the door was still open, but when God shut the door, it's shut. You get this here. That echo is here. They go in for the wedding feast. The door is shut. What happens next? Later, the rest of the virgins also came and said, "Master, Master, open to us." He replied, "Truly I tell you, I don't know you." A very stern statement. Really a devastating statement. The door is shut. They've now tried to make themselves ready, but it's too late. That too is to be understood as a warning. Is it ever too late? The answer is yes. Yes. It can be too late. And we could flesh that out in several different ways. I've even heard sermons used back to the days of Noah that my spirit will not always strive with men. His days will be 120 years. The warning there in the context of Noah and the ark is simply that there will come a time that it's too late. It's too late. The horrifying thing is, if you're standing on the outside when the door is shut, and the realization comes across your mind in a terrifying way, it's too late. Now, I know that some have an idea that there's some sort of second chance. The doctrine coming from the Middle Ages in the Roman Catholic tradition of purgatory was one method of trying to... Well, actually, I don't think it still sounds too crass, but purgatory was a fundraising attempt.
Yeah.
And it worked very well. There was even a slogan: every time the coffer rings, a soul from purgatory springs. Mm-hmm. Catholic Encyclopedia, when you're looking at the entry on purgatory, at least years and years ago it was there, if it's not been edited out, said that this doctrine has basically no biblical support. But for Catholics, you don't need it if you have a pope that affirms it, okay? Or tradition, church tradition that would affirm it. There is nothing in the Bible that offers any, even a glimpse of a second chance. Everybody's going to be believers once they die.
Yeah.
Everybody. But there comes a time when there is no chance. And now here, he finishes it. Therefore be alert, because you don't know either the day or the hour. Now he's going back and he's affirming that again. He already said that in chapter 24. No one knows the day or the hour. And he's underscoring that. No one knows the day or the hour. So when someone comes, writes a book, or has a television special, or whatever it might be, and talks about the he or she sets the time, what are you to do?
Ignore them.
Ignore them. If necessary, run from them because they're lying. Why is it that people believe that? Lots of people do and have. It's amazing to me that Jehovah's Witnesses have existed to this day, because if you go back in time, they set all kinds of dates when Jesus was coming back. I want to say one of them was 1919, one's 1914, and there was a whole, I don't know, there was several. I don't remember all the details, but several of those being set. And people do that. And there are enough gullible Christians out there that don't know the Bible well enough to realize that they are false. Okay. Comments or questions about this particular parable?
In verse 9, where the first five virgins told them, rather, to them, to go to them that will sell and buy for yourselves. What do you... Do you have anything to say about that?
I think it's just a detail in the story that, okay, the wise bridesmaids, they do not have enough oil for themselves and their unwise bridesmaids. So, hey, if you need oil, go get some. But they're not prepared. So their effort is just a wasted effort. Because they're still going to be, they're locked out because they're too late. It's not so much the detail of going to find somebody that sells oil. They can bang on the door and somebody will come to the door and they can buy oil. The problem is they're not ready when they need to be ready.
I guess what came to my mind is after the rapture. Those who survive the mass destruction.
Well, if we understand the chronology correctly, following the rapture and going into the Great Tribulation, there will be numerous people, maybe even thousands of people that will turn to Christ. They'll suffer for it, but they will be some of that. I'm not sure that this will work. The reason why I think it's just a detail that Jesus added is for this reason. He replied, verse 12, "Truly I tell you, I don't know you." That seems to close the possibility of that being a after the rapture kind of thing. Because that's what they hear. They're not going to be allowed in. He tells that, yes.
What exactly is the preparation that they aren't? What are they not prepared?
The groom's coming.
That's obvious. But what is it spiritually that they aren't?
The point is, Jesus is. Remember, he's still dealing with the question the disciples ask. When will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming? Well, this is what it's going to be like when he comes. And he's warning those, his followers, you need to be prepared. You need to be ready. He's going to reinforce that with the next parable, which is more, it's a parable. He's going to reinforce that. And then he's going to bring it to almost a crescendo, as it were, an apex in the judgment of the sheep and the goats. And you're going to see how these are just, he's stacking one on top of the other. You know, pay attention. Be prepared. Be ready. And it doesn't mean that you never fall asleep, because they fell asleep. But the difference was, one group was ready, the other group, I should say, one group is prepared, the other group is not prepared. One group is ready for the bridegroom showing up, the other group not ready when he does come. Make sense to you? That's the emphasis that's being made over and over in this particular expression that Jesus is telling these stories. So he goes on. In the next one, the parable of the talents. This is a very important one too. The word talent can throw you for a loop. It's not about your ability to sing. It's not about any kind of particular spiritual gift that you have, per se. Now, there's some application points that will overlap there. But a talent is a sum of money. That's what it is. It's a sum of money, and it's worth about 6,000 denarii, or about 20 years' wages. It's a considerable amount of money. But it's money. Okay? That I want you to be sure to get a hold of, because the word talent sometimes... We can mislead us a bit because of our use of the word talent. Talent means ability or skill that someone might have. Someone may have a musical talent, or someone might have a mathematical talent, ability. That can be applied using it for God's glory or not, but that's a secondary issue. To understand what he's talking about, he's telling another parable that everybody was familiar with. Sometimes wealthy individuals, powerful people, would go on trips for business-related issues mainly. Now, transportation is nothing close to what we have today. So a trip, you know, we can think, you know, if it's a 2-week trip, that's a long time, isn't it? What about 5 or 6 years? What kind of trip would that be? Or even longer. Or even longer. Kind of like, Homer's Odyssey. What, 20 years or something? You know, it's a long trip. But, you know, for example, to kind of give you an idea of this a little bit, when the Romans were putting down the Jews in the Jewish War, that included the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple. That war lasted from AD 66 to AD 73. Can you imagine, you know, your soldier, your husband, your son being gone for that long? You don't know if he's alive or dead. You don't know where he is for sure, but he's gone for that protracted period of time. That would be almost like... You get a point. So when people travel, they would travel on business, whatever, it could be a considerable time. That's a point to keep in mind. There's no communication to speak of, so any kind of message would have to be carried by someone on foot. No Pony Express. So a letter is going to take a long time. So for a businessman being gone for a long time, you know, sending a letter telling somebody when he's going to be home, well, you really don't know exactly when he's going to be home. You know, this year, next year, you know, wherever. Keep that in mind as we work our way down through this. For it's just like a man about to go on a journey. He called his own servants and entrusted his possessions to them. To one he gave 5 talents. To another, 2 talents, and to another, 1 talent, depending on each one's ability. Then he went on a journey. Immediately, the man who had received 5 talents went and put them to work and earned 5 more. In the same way, the man who earned 2 went out and had 2 went out and earned 2 more. And the man who had 1 talent went off and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. So they're stewards. It's not their money, but it's their responsibility to care for what they've been entrusted. Two of the servants, the slaves, they know exactly what their master wants him to do. So the one that has five, he goes out and he loans the money payments back. He receives it with interest. So he makes money for his master. Again, a common thing in that day. The guy that had two, he goes out and does his thing. Now, he does not necessarily seem to be as... Well, he doubles what the master had. And you'll find in a moment that, if I go a little bit further, that he gives them according to their... depending on each one's ability in verse 15. And as he sends them out and do that, one... But there's one. There's one fellow that has less ability, perhaps. And his master gives him one talent. 6,000 denarii. He knows what he's supposed to do with the two, but he doesn't do it. He takes the money, he takes it and he hides it. And then what does he do? Well, we don't know what he does, but we know what he doesn't do. He's not faithful as the other two servants are. So then after a period of time, after a long time, the master of his servants came and settled accounts with them. The man who had received five talents approached and presented five more talents and said, "Master, you have given me five talents. See, I have earned five more talents." His master said to him, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You are faithful over a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Share your master's joy." Now, I want you to remember that this is the guy that made the most. Okay? All right? Now, let's move to the next one. The man who had two talents also approached. He said, "Master, you gave me two talents. See, I have earned two more talents." His master said to him, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Share your master's joy." Both servants... the same response is given to them. There's not a comparison going on. The master didn't say, "Well, yeah, you did pretty good, you know, two talent guy, but what about the guy that had at five?" He doesn't do that. He doesn't do that at all. He gives the same reward to each man. What, you've been faithful over a few things? I'm going to give you responsibility over many things. Now, we'll take a little side road here. You do realize, I'm sure, that the heavenly rewards vary from person to person. Did you know that? Do you know that there will be people that will receive far greater acknowledgement than others? But everyone that's been faithful is going to hear the same thing. What's the same thing? "Well done, good and faithful servant." Not everybody can be Billy Graham. But that's not the standard that God rewards for. He rewards for faithfulness. Not necessarily what we would consider success, but faithfulness. I would submit to you that there will be people that will probably we have never heard of, history books have no record of, that will be receiving rewarded far greater than a lot of people that we thought should receive a lot more. But those that remain faithful will be handsomely rewarded because they were faithful. Now what about the unfaithful guy? This is how an unfaithful person talks. They give all kinds of excuses. They offer all kinds of reasons. "Well, I couldn't do this because of that. I would have been a lot more faithful if I would have lived at this time in history. Listen, this is what an unfaithful person, this is how they act. The one who received one talent also approached and said, "Master, I know you. You're a harsh man. You're reaping where you haven't sown. You gather where you haven't scattered seed. So I was afraid and went off and hid your talent in the ground. See, you have what is yours." That's how an unfaithful person talks. They give excuses. Now, the other two servants don't seem to look at their master that way, do they? They're not suggesting that he's harsh and he's mean and he's dubious and he takes what isn't his. They don't indicate that at all, but this guy does. He's pointing out, you know, you're not a very good guy. And I was afraid. So what I did, I just went and buried it in the ground. You're back. I dug it up. Here it is. Then his master is going to respond to him. His master replied, "You evil, lazy servant. If you knew that I reap where I haven't sown and gathered where I haven't scattered, then you should have deposited my money with the bankers, and I would have received my money back with interest when I returned. So take the talent from him and give it to the one who has 10. For everyone who has, more will be given, and he who does not, and he will have more than enough. But from the one who does not have, even what he has will be taken away from him. Throw him, this unfaithful servant, into outer darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." We've heard that before. We hear it again. When you look at these three servants, what's the issue? What's the difference? Well, there's several differences, but yes.
Faithfulness.
Faithfulness is key. And also, you've got the issue of preparedness. Don't let that slip away because it's still here. The faithful servants, the one that had 5 and the one that had 2, they went out and they were busy doing what their master wanted them to do. So in essence, they were preparing for his coming. The other one wasn't. He wasn't. And I would even take it maybe an implied statement or an implied, I think, feature of the story, is that the third servant didn't really know his master. What do I mean by that? Well, look at the impression that he has. You're a harsh man. You reap where you have not sown. You gather where you have not scattered any seed. I was afraid. I went off and hid your talent in the ground. Let's back up just a little bit. The first servant. Now he's presenting not only the 5, but 5 more. His master said to him, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You were faithful in over a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Share your master's joy." The second guy, significantly less, but nevertheless, his master said to him, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Share your master's joy." Now that's telling us something about the master. The third guy, what's his take? "Well, you're a harsh man. You gather what you haven't sowed. You take what you haven't, you reap what you haven't, you know." The accusations there are way off base compared to the other two. Are you seeing this? Are you seeing that? Good, good. And then the end result, the two that were shown themselves faithful, they are given more responsibility and they come into their master's joy. The one that looks at his master and doesn't trust him, obviously doesn't love him nor respect him, he finds himself to be cast in outer darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Again, a warning. Is it kind of vivid? Is it so, a sobering warning? You better pay attention here. It should be. It should be. And then we move to what chapter 25 is most known for. And I'm not sure we'll be able to make it through all of it, but maybe we'll hit the high points of it and you'll see. It's the issue of separation once again. You'll be surprised if you go back and you begin thinking about the idea of separation. You go back and look at the Sermon on the Mount, you will find separation. The separating going on. How many ways are there? There's two ways. There's one way to life, one way to destruction. There are two foundations. There are, you go on, you see it over and over and over. There are several different expressions there of this division that's going to take place. Here it is expressed. And again, they knew about this. They've seen herds of sheep and goats. The same herd might contain both sheep and goats. Sheep are more valuable than goats because sheep, you can remove their wool and make clothing out of it and other kind of items. Goats, no, not really. Now, goats produce milk. I mean, they're useful. They also produce meat. They're useful. Of course, lambs do too, but there obviously is a difference. And there is the issue of Jesus is saying, remember the question? What was the question? What will be the sign of your coming? When will these things take place? Verse 31, when the Son of Man comes in His glory, along with His holy angels with Him, then He will sit on His glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered before Him. Okay. Now the scope has broadened. Before we were talking about Jewish things, the temple being destroyed, those kind of things. But now he's expanded it. It's not just the Jews in view here. All the nations, all the people groups are going to be gathered before Him. And as the nations are gathered before Him, He will separate them one from the other, just as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. Very interesting dynamic. They were, again, very much aware of it. They saw shepherds do this. When it came time to separate the animals, they would separate them. Goats in one area, sheep in a different area. And He will put the sheep on His right hand and the goats on His left. Now, again, pretty clear. Usually, even in the ancient world, most people are right-handed. You will have the anomaly of a left-handed person every once in a while. Usually left-handed people end up being president, but that's another story. So on the right side, you have the sheep. On the left side, of course, your right and left is the opposite of mine. So on the right side, the sheep. On the left side, are the goats. All right, and then he goes on. And then the king will say to those on his right, come you who are blessed of my Father and inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. This is not just, God thinking up a plan on the fly here. This plan goes back before the world was ever even created. Before creation, before Genesis 1:1, God already knew this. He's already prepared a kingdom. And inherit the kingdom prepared for you by the foundation of the world. Verse 35. For I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you took care of me. I was in prison and you visited me. Then the righteous will answer him. Now I want you to notice the answer. The answer for both the sheep and the goats is the same. They're the same. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you as a stranger and take you in, or without clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and visit you? And the king, notice, he talks about himself, he's already talking about himself sitting on a throne, But now he refers to himself as the king. I missed that earlier, but I want to emphasize it here. The king will answer and say to them, truly I tell you, whenever you did it for the least of these, you did it for me. They didn't know it. They didn't realize it. But they were doing it anyway. Now, you do understand that in the ancient world, there were no social programs. And I'm not giving you an excuse not to be kind to those in need. I'm not doing that at all. But I want you to understand, there were nothing. There's nothing there. And if someone was struggling, if someone was ill, someone was... They had no resources to speak of. But these people cared. Now, there's a reason why they cared. The reason why they cared is because of their relationship to the shepherd or the king. That's why. Verse 41. Then he will say to those on his left, if you listen to the warning here. Depart from me, you who are cursed, into eternal fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you didn't take me in. I was naked, and you didn't clothe me. Sick and in prison, you didn't care for me. And they too will answer, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty, or a stranger, or without clothes, or sick, or in prison, and not help you? The response is the same. When? When? Then he will answer them, truly I tell you, whatever you did not do to the least of these, you did not do for me. In other words, that there is something separated them, the goats, from their shepherd or their king. The one, the sheep, were reflecting the nature of the one that they were serving. The goats, those on the left, they didn't. They're not like him. They're not like him. And they will go away into eternal punishment. But the righteous into eternal life. We can spend a lot of time here, but one of the things to bear in mind, and it's a tragic thing, that in Matthew chapter 7, when there was this division going on, those saying, Lord, Lord, did we not do this in your name, do that in your name? The problem happens is the goats think they're sheep, not realizing they're goats. And if you take chapter 7 in the Sermon on the Mount and this one and couple them together, you begin seeing that. Depart from me, you cursed ones. I don't know you. Indicating, and nor do you know me. Now, I'm going to lay aside a heresy that needs to be stated or corrected. There have been scholars, even at one time in their early ministries, very reputable, conservative, good Bible theologians, that have tripped over something, and it's a doctrine that they just don't want to deal with, and that is the doctrine of hell or eternal punishment. The fancy term is called annihilationism. The belief is that when an unsaved person dies, that God just simply annihilates them. The concern is, for someone suffering for all eternity, seems to be excessive and unfair and brutal and even vicious. A person who commits finite sins is going to experience an infinite punishment. The fairness of that seems to be untenable. No, it can't be right. Well, let me address that a couple of ways. One, maybe this will help. Say, I get ticked at Gary. And I'm in front of a bunch of witnesses. I get, Gary, I'm going to catch you. I'm going to kill you. I am so mad at you. No, I'm not, okay? I'm not. But I say that in front of all you witnesses. Well, you go to the sheriff's department. You tell him what I said. And the sheriff listens to what you say. He comes, or a deputy comes and talks to me. And see how serious I am about that or whatever, you know. And he realizes I'm just shooting my mouth off. Mouth and brain are not connected. You know, one of those kind of deals. But if I did the same thing about the president, you think the response is going to be the same? Why? What's the difference? Gary, to me, is just as important as the president. Actually, more so, but... you know the point, right? Are you grasping what I'm trying to make? The point in making the threat or the crime against it varies in intensity depending on who it's against, right? So we need to realize that. So when we talk about eternal punishment, just stop for a moment. Who is the sin ultimately against? It's not simply against another human being. It's against the infinite, eternal God, the holy, the righteous one. It's a crime that eternal punishment makes perfect sense because of who it is against. We need to realize that. Now, having said that, there's another aspect of this. It's very important. And it is the adjective. And they will go away into eternal punishment. Not just punishment. Eternal punishment. But the righteous into eternal life. It's the same word. If annihilationism is true and there is no eternal state of punishment for those who have violated God's commands and those who are unrepentant and leave this life without receiving Christ's forgiveness and righteousness, if they are, you know, zeroed out, what about the righteous? It's the same word. Meaning the same thing. Eternal. Eternal. Meaning it's not, there's no end to it. Now, there's a lot more we can say about that. But you see, back here, in chapter 24, 25, or 24, 51, there is a place for the hypocrites where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. And then you drop down into this, the parable of the talents, and throw this good-for-nothing servant into outer darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And then you go down here to the last verse here in 25, and they will go away into eternal punishment. But then following that is the contrast with the righteous to eternal life. The sheep inherit the kingdom. The goats don't. And the goats think they're sheep. Only to find out too late that they're goats. That they're goats. Well, you got 2 minutes or 3 minutes. Questions or comments? Yes.
Yeah, I hear people say, oh, well, I'll get right with God later. And that just scares me to death to hear people say that.
That's what the bridesmaid said. Look at, you know, No hurry.
I think that's why people wanna know a sign that's coming and know the hour and the date, so that, you know, then they think, okay, now I know I can live how I want right up until that point.
Yeah, just a minute before that, you get slipped out. If you're afforded that kind of opportunity, I want to tell you, and I've told you this before, I want to tell you a very, very strange, to me strange, phenomenon. Okay? I've been around over the years more terminally ill people than I can even count. Do you know that even someone who knows, you know, hasn't fiddled away, doesn't ignore, that knows that their death is imminent, could be any time, but it could be very soon, the majority of those folks are still refusing to deal with God. I wish I could explain why. You think the older a person gets, the more thinking about those kind of things they would be, but that's just simply not the case. It's simply not the case.
I remember when Andy's grandmother had terminal cancer, and she struggled with, you know, what does God want with me now? Just this little bit, what would he, you know, and the pastor that was with her said, what would he want with any of us? You know, but as she struggled, but she didn't get saved before she passed away, which praise God for that. But that was her stumbling block, was like, you know, why would he bother with me at this point?
Right. And there's a lot of things. See, Satan doesn't let go even at the last moments. So there'll be all kinds of things that he will continue to bombard someone with. Like that very thought. That very thought. You'd think people would want to get ready. But they don't. They don't. I've told you that anecdotal story several times. One more time, you can tolerate it. It goes back to the day, to the days of George W. Truett, the pastor of the First Baptist Church in Dallas, Texas, was talking about a particular experience that he had. He was in a, of course it was a buggy, horse and buggy, horse-drawn carriage that he was in, with the father of a young woman who had died. It was his, you know, his daughter. And he was riding with Truett as they went to the cemetery for a committal service. And as they were going, they were talking. And the man said, Dr. Truett, I have a question to ask you. Has your preaching changed? Truett wasn't kind of taken back, said, I don't think so. What do you mean? He said, well, for several years, I would come and slip into the very back of the First Baptist Church. I'd listen to you preach. I would literally hang on to the pew in front of me so I wouldn't step out in the aisle. I would do that, and then after the service, I would walk around the streets of Dallas for 2 or 3 hours thinking about the things that you had said. It wasn't that long ago I was slipped back in on that back seat. I listened to you preach. I didn't have to hold on to anything at all. Has your preaching changed? Truett, in that recollection, says, I didn't have the heart to tell him at that point, of course going to the cemetery, that there come a time when the drawing presence of God was no longer going to draw.
That's right.
The door was shut. And it can happen. It can happen. Well, thank you.
Thank you.